Well, I was originally with Long Range Weapons Establishment, LRWE, which became WRE, based at Salisbury. I worked on a lot of the early missiles up at Woomera. So I was a long time Woomera resident. And I worked with all the old fatals. I worked with Tom Reed, and I worked with Bob Leslie, Frank Normandy. My father was a 10-pound Tom. He was in the Second World War. He was an instructor on gun control and that sort of thing. So we came out here in 1949, and I was a 15-year-old, and I think around about when I was a 17-year-old, I joined Long Range Weapons as a cadet engineer, or assistant AEO, Assistant Experimental Officer. I then left, I worked with WRE for quite some time, and then I joined one of the contractors, initially EMI, and worked on a glide bomb there, on a TV system on a glide bomb, and then went with De Havilland Aircraft, with De Havs. The intention was, when I joined WRE, that as a cadet engineer, that I would in fact eventually be sponsored to go to university. Somehow that didn't ever happen. And I don't know, I was possibly very naive myself. I didn't push it, and for some reason either my father didn't. Mm-hmm. He was also working at WRE as an experimental officer. And my younger brother also worked at WRE. But I don't know, in those days it seemed to be quite a rush on it. It was the Cold War period, and it was being taken ever so seriously. We had to do things. Security was very, very high. And so after a year or so, I questioned a couple of times, but I didn't know, as a kid, I didn't push things very hard when I was going to start training, and it never did happen. And then I was on a pittance of a wage, and they kept giving me a number of what we called radio tradesmen to do various jobs, installation jobs, and they just didn't ever, they always were earning many, many times what I was. So I left them, and I joined EMI, and they gave me an adult wage. Then again with De Havilland, and I worked through a number of programs with De Havilland on their Black Knight, and then on Blue Streak. And my boss was always John Galbraith. He was the one that originally set up the staff. And so when Blue Streak eventually failed, or the contract was cancelled, then the Space Track was set up, and I joined in 1963. Monday, the 1st of July, I joined Space Track, and almost immediately went over to America.
Was that to JPL, or where did you go?
I didn't go with the boys. Most of the boys went straight out to Goldstone.
Mm-hmm.
I went to quite a bit of training. I went to the Lenkert Carriers. Lenkerts were going to provide the microwave link. So I went to Lenkerts, did some training there. I also went to ITT Kellogg's. And at that stage, we didn't have any communication system. Bob Leslie at the time, I must have run into him at some time. Several times I went down to Goldstone to see what was happening there. And I'd run into Bob Leslie, and he didn't like the intercom system that they had at Goldstone. This was this so-called 112A system, much, much too elaborate for a tracking station. And Bob was very, very familiar with communication systems because he worked at the range. And so my boss at JPL, Bill Bridges, he set about designing a system, or putting together the requirements for a system for the new tracking stations, which was 42 was the new one on the block of that day. The construction hadn't been finished at that stage. So I worked with Bill Bridges and ITT Kellogg's, went through the design and eventual delivery of communications we had at Tibbinvilla. I didn't ever quite get my way, or Bob Lisbett's way, so when we got it, we modified it anyway. It was a brand new system, much simpler than the 112A, and technically very, very much better. The 112A system was a terrible system. The maintenance was very, very high, and the quality was poor. It took a lot of work to maintain, and it was, for a tracking station, it just wasn't necessary of that complexity. So I think I eventually moved to Canberra. Let me see, when was this? I moved to Canberra on the 1st of March 1964 with my family, and I then again went back to JPL in June 64. Oh, that was it. I went back there to go through the acceptance testing of the communication system. So the first time we were just putting things together, I then went back for the acceptance of it. It was just an ITT Kellogg system. It was a five-channel, fairly simple, but a very, very nice, clean system, and very simple to maintain and to install. A single cable with a connector on the end of it, whereas this the system they used in the MSFM wing eventually, which was they put the 112A system in there, again, we heavily modified it to bring it up into a reasonable standard. Bob Leslie was always very keen on us doing what modifications we thought were necessary. Tom Reeb was always dead against any modification, and I ran into a lot of strife with Tom on that several times. So the communications, they sort of sit in a corner and they just provide a service. We don't sort of get much, I don't know, we just do a job there, and our job doesn't really change much, regardless of what's happening in the station, and I don't think we ever had a failure.
Tell me if I'm jumping ahead, but how did the comms from Tibbinvilla get into Canberra, and where from there to JPL?
A landline into Deakin, the Deakin Switching Centre there. We had permanent lines, permanent telephone lines from the comms centre into Deakin, both telephone lines and lines. All of the data was sent on telegraph. It was all TTY telegraph line. We had a very, very elementary high-speed data. I think it was 1,200 bits per second. And we're talking about megabits these days. But the original system was 1,200, but most of the data went on telegraph lines. Mind you, in deep space, the bit rate coming back from the spacecraft was very low anyway, so the telegraph lines were able to handle that bit rate. So from Deakin, it was landlines all the way to undersea cables, and within Australia, of course, it was carried by GBO. But we had permanent lines, I think it was maybe two lines, all the time into JPL. But most of the communication was by telegraph, and I had about four or five telegraph operators. If the station was being manned, and quite often it was running 24 hours a day, then we would have telegraph operators on site all the time. And the majority of the communication, technical communication between the stations and JPL were by telegraph. It was possible to have, it was called a scammer. We were able to set up the scammer calls, but it was a bit messy. It meant finding the person on the other end and setting things up. And then it was never very comfortable having a call on the scammer line, because you knew everyone was sort of listening in on your conversation. I think while I was there, I had about five or maybe six trips over to America, and I was totaling up a few years ago. Of the 10 years I was at the tracking station, I spent a total of 1 year in the state.
So you started at Tibimbilla, what, July 64, so that was, what, 9 or 10 months before the opening?
Yes, that's right.
And you were, what, just getting the station up and running and all of the communications lines?
Yes, just installing equipment there. And it was quite a reasonable job. There were lots of different communication points all over the antenna. And, of course, when the 210-foot came in, we then had, I can't remember, there was possibly 10 or 15 intercommunication points all over the antenna, and they all had to be installed. It was a rack-mounted, about 3.5 inches in height, and the full rack width. It catered for two operators. Two operators could plug their headsets in. Majority of times, it was only used by one operator. So the two positions, they had a five position, I think it was, switch, and you could choose what channel you wanted to. And whatever you were pointed to on your station, that's the one you could talk to. If it was a single operator, then could use the knob on the other side and listen on that channel. So that was the normal mode of operation. All of the internal people would be on one channel and they'd be able to talk together. That they'd be listening to the channel that was between the station and JPL.
Okay.
It was then possible if a little group needed to get together somewhere, they could nominate a channel and go their hardest on their own little loop. That didn't happen very much. Most of the time, they were all on the internal channel and listening to the JPL channel. And it became very convenient that way, such that the moment JPL channel started talking, either the op supervisor or JPL, then you'd normally stop your internal communications and listen to what's happening on the net. And that became quiet, then you'd carry on and do your own work. Or if you had something special to do, you'd nominate a channel and you'd go off somewhere else. Right?
So Paddy Johnston, he was the op supervisor, wasn't he?
Yes, our Paddy. Yes, he was one of the original op supervisors. Yeah, Vicar, Bruce Window, of course, Tony Keeler. Offsider was Harry Vonderdop. We had another very colourful character, Dixie Polmere. He was an ex-PMG technician, and he was looking after all of our teletype equipment. There was a war vet. Quite a character. ever such a solid guy. It was a very tight knit sort of group there. All in those days relatively young, all round about the same age. There was the odd elderly person there, but all moving sort of there from somewhere else. We spent a lot of time socially together as well.
Bob Leslie must have been one of the older ones, was he?
Oh, yes, he was the original one. He would have been one of the older ones, yes. I think there was a Jack Rossall. I think he was older than most of us. Or some of the admin. We had Major Donnelly. In the early days, we used the accommodation quite a bit in the accommodation wing. I think there were a dozen or so rooms where we had our meals. And in the early days, for some reason or other, we used to do extremely long shifts. And I spent many, many nights in the accommodation there. A couple that I did know very well, knew Bob Cudmore, he was a personal friend, and John Galbraith. I'd been with John many, many years before the tracking station. It's when I joined de Havilland Aircraft.
Okay. So when you were with de Havilland, was that WIMA or was that other projects you were working on then?
Yes, de Havilland, it was with Black Knight. That was a Saunders Row with the builders of it. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was a project, I think, designed to fail. It was designed by the RAE in England.
Mm.
And they gave the contract to Saunders Roe to build it. They gave the contract to de Havilland Aircraft to fire it. And they gave the contract to WRE to do all the ground instrumentation. And everything was running late. So it was very, very difficult for all those people to keep talking to each other. I think the typical government project that was, whilst it was supposed to be designed, once I say designed to fail, I think we had 22 firings and there was not a complete failure in any one of them. Several of them didn't quite achieve their objective. My job on that one was WRE had the contract to do all the ground electrical installation, the wiring of all the consoles. They were all sent out from England, but all had to be joined together. And they couldn't find any people to do it, so John Galbraith asked me to do it, and we hired four or five wiremen. And because I'd been with WRE, I'd ex-WRE, they knew me, and they allowed me to do the installation on their behalf. Again, quite a odd set of circumstances. Ralph Hall was doing the mechanical installation. He was running behind, and so once I finished my electrical installation, I finished off the mechanical installation, and then somehow I got a mechanical hat because I became the mechanical section leader.
Right.
And I was responsible for preparing the missile for launching and fueling and all the rest of it. I did that for quite a number of years, I think up until about BK-7, Black Knight 7 or 8. And that's when I then moved on to Blue Streak, that was the missile to deliver an atomic bomb. We then found that atomic bombs were then, they could build them very much smaller and didn't need such a large vehicle to launch them. And that's when tracking station job came along. That's when I transferred. I did run with another project with the de Havillands, and that was there was a lot of firings going on at Woomera, quite a few every day. It was quite a busy time, and a lot of the launches were being used for testing missiles and testing what might happen if they went wrong on the launch, to protect the launcher or to protect the ship or find out what would happen to the ship or the aircraft. De Havilland set up a little section that could be ready to refit launchers. And in fact, we set up this little group. We were told that we had to try and become self-sufficient. So there were three or four of us, one, two, three, five of us, and we went out and we just got commercial jobs. We did quite a bit of work for Holden's, who were just next door to us, and quite a few businesses there. And it is, in fact, the Skylark, the Sea Slug launcher, got badly damaged, and we were able to immediately go in and do some work there and restore it. So that was another interesting job. I think it was only on for about 9 months.
Okay, so for the Tidbinbilla job, did you apply for that, or did they say, here's something we'd like you to do?
When Hawker Siddeley's got the contract and formed the space pack, then they had to get the staff, and I think I was the only one that came out of the original company. So I was already with de Havilland, and de Havilland got the job, and so I'd already been working for John, and he knew me quite well, and so he immediately took me on. When I joined WRE, my very first job was working with a guy by the name of Ted Peppercorn. At those days, it was very difficult to find mobile transmitter receivers that could go into a Land Rover.
Mm-hmm.
And so WRE, or Long Range Weapons, decided that they would build their own. And Ted Peppercorn was also an amateur radio guy. So he designed a two-way radio that would fit into a Land Rover. Now, I joined him three-quarters of the way through there. The prototype was just about finished. And I fitted this into a Land Rover and did the test on it. But then I got to know Len Bedell. Does the name ring a bell at
all? Oh, yes. He was one of the pioneers of Woomera, wasn't he?
Pioneers of Woomera, yes.
He was the, what, surveyor?
Yes, he was a surveyor, and he surveyed the Maralinga site. And he used these transceivers for that expedition. So each night he would call up the range and Ted Peppercorn and order his supplies, and there'd be an airdrop or something like that, or just give a report on where he had got to. And I remember a couple of times security, Ted left some notes out of this, and security would grab the notes and lock all of our filing cabinets, and in fact lock the door at one time, and you'd be hauled over the coals because of leaving things out. But all the time, I had a map of Australia stuck on the wall. And as he called in where he was, I put pins in the map. No time did the security ever realize that those pins in the map were, in fact, the route that was going for the atomic bomb site of Maralinga.
Right. So when you were doing this, you and Ted, were you at Woomera or at...
No, this is all being done at Salisbury.
Salisbury, South Australia, yep.
When I was doing this job where we were contracting to Holden's and places like that, the guy that my boss then was Tubby Vale, and he was mixed up in American Projects Division somewhere. I don't think he ever got onto the tracking stations, but he was he and Bob Leslie had quite a bit to do with each other. I think they were writing up stuff about the tracking stations. I don't know.
Oh, so that was Taffy.
It was Tubby Vale.
Tubby.
I forget what his proper name was now.
Tubby Vale. Okay.
T-U-B-B-Y. Tubby. And I worked with Frank Northey at one time for a while, and he was one of the assistant directors at Bimbello. I didn't know Don Gray very well. I had met him in Woomera. Certainly, we would have known each other there. So when I went there, I knew Bob Leslie very well. Tom Reed, he was in the street just behind me when I lived in Woomera. And our wives were very, very friendly. But we met up fairly regularly. So I got to know Tom quite well. So I didn't know any of the other staff, except some of the WRE station directors and that sort of stuff. I didn't know anyone else on the tracking station. And whenever I went to America, they all went to the tracking stations, and I normally stayed at JPL or went out to contractors. Later, when the MSFN wing came along, we needed to join the two systems together, and I think I went back to JPL for that. So I didn't spend that much time at Goldstone, so I didn't spend much time with the rest of the gang.
So when it came to connecting the wing to the original section at Tibbinbilla, how complicated was that?
It wasn't very, technically it wasn't very difficult at all. One of the main reasons that I went over there was to try not to have that horrible 112A system for the wing. So we eventually got it, but it wasn't on the antennas, fortunately. It was our system on the antennas. However, it all worked. are you familiar with the Tibbinbilla building? When you go up the steps into the main door, it is necessary to go up another flight of steps to go into the operations area. Before you get up, when you get to the first set of steps, there is a room immediately on the left. You go down a little passage, and the room, that's where the comm center started. And then when the communications equipment came, we then moved it all up top into another area.
So the station evolved and things got bigger as time went on. You had lots of visitors from the US for the particular missions. Had the Hughes people for Surveyor.
Yes, and that to me was, I suppose, Man in Space was more inspiring. But the Surveyor one was an incredible one. It was almost like taking photographs yourself, and it was a real hands-on. You could really see fruit for your labour. It was an amazing, amazing thing. Yeah.
And amazingly successful, wasn't it?
It certainly was, yes. Yes. They were most enjoyable days. I thoroughly enjoyed that. And it was like taking a photograph. It's not in focus, so do we have to go in or out? We'll try out or a long way to go in.
So where were you physically present during a mission? In the comms room?
Always in the comms centre, yes. Yeah. Mm. We had a separate net on the side, but always talking to other people, and occasionally a line would go down and we'd make a swap and the operations people wouldn't know about it. And especially in the early days when we were sending teletype transmissions, if we were using a particular line for a transmission, we'd always be having another line with some dummy data going on it, just to check that it was still in good use, just in case we needed it. There always seemed to be something to do there. Thinking back on it, I can't imagine what we did all the time. we always seemed to be busy. What we didn't, I don't know whether anyone saved it, on every mission, we had a tape recorder of all the conversation that was going on all the time. It was a voice-operated tape, mm-hmm. and we had hundreds of rolls of tape, all catalogued.
I wonder what happened to those.
Yes, it would be interesting. Mm. And that would have carried on all the way through through the Man in Space projects.
So there were quite a few changes in the kinds of missions supported when Apollo came along.
Yes, it was. More thrilling, I suppose, more than that. By that time, the tracking had become a little bit old hat. By the time I left, it wasn't really holding my interest that much. Mm. But I say I thoroughly enjoyed it. And in addition, all my family were back in South Australia, so I was getting a bit homesick, I think.
So when did you leave Tibbenbilla?
Well, that was 10 years later. Let me see, I've got a date here somewhere. Right, 1st of June 1973.
So just after the opening of DSS 43. And so what did you do after that?
My brother and I, we started a fruit processing factory.
Right.
For the next 10 years, we exported fruit all over the world. That was from South Australia. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, so most of my family were in what's called the Riverland of South Australia. This is semi-desert area, but a lot of vines and fruit-growing area. So I moved back there and didn't do much for a while, but eventually my wife found a nice house, but it had 40 acres of vines. And so I became a vineyard operator. But unfortunately, I damaged my back. And I say fortunately, unfortunately. But again, fortunately for me, this property was on about 5 titles, and I was able to recover my money quite handsomely with that. But at the same time, my young brother had a similar property, and he was, in fact, drying all of his fruit and making it into a confectionery. I then started to visit him on crutches. Anyway, I gradually was able to throw the crutches away, and I found I was helping him. So we then formed a company, and we moved slightly closer to, the first time we hired rented a building in Renmark,
mm-hmm.
and we then started processing fruit and using an evaporator and pasteurizer and storing it in 44-gallon drums. And we then exported that we moved several times as the business was growing. And eventually we were exporting about $5 million worth into Germany. Once it was a change of career, my previous workings worked for me ever so well. In my missile days, I'd done quite a bit of work on hydraulics and pneumatics. I've always had a yen for electronics, and so I did all the electrical work, and we had to modify evaporators to do what we were doing. So all my previous work sort of came in well there. So that was the next 10 years. From there, I contracted for quite some time. I worked for BHP in Whyalla, and contracted to do a particular job at Whyalla. This was to install a large hydraulic device. But then the chief electrical engineer went on long service leave, so I was chief electrical engineer at Whyalla for, I think, about 6 months while this person was on leave. Oh, then if you remember, on the turn of the century, there was the Y2K. So I spent 2 years on Y2K. And myself and two guys, we did most of the Telstra. And in fact, I also did a survey on DSTO and several places in Canberra there. So around about the year 2000, I sort of retired. And I just did not like retirement one little bit. And but my son has a business in the Riverland of South Australia, an engineering business, and I started to do some work for him. And so for the last 20 years, since the year 2001, I think it was, I've been working for my son, and I still work for my son. So every 2 weeks, I go to the Riverland. I have to drive 350 kilometres. I do 2 days and then drive home, but I do a lot of work then at home. And it's quite interesting. Again, it's things in your past help you. Over the 20 years, I've helped, I say my son. My son has three partners. My son is in the construction part, and his other partner makes these stainless steel vessels you might have seen at wineries, these huge great big tanks. So we churn them out. So over the last 20 years, we've bought a lot of equipment out of Italy to make things faster and make it safer, make it better. But they take a lot of maintenance. It's quite difficult. Again, hydraulic, pneumatic, a lot of computers, PLCs, and in several jobs I did quite a bit of programming, so I thoroughly enjoyed programming. So I've written quite a few programs for the company, and I keep all of their computer-controlled equipment running and modified.
That's fascinating.
It is fascinating. I don't know how other companies get on, but we're finding that some of this equipment that we bought from overseas, it's normally fairly heavy piece of equipment because it's rolling steel and that sort of thing. So it's normally companies that are foundries that make heavy pieces of equipment. They make the basic of equipment, and then they say, well, all right, it's got to be driven by hydraulics. So they then get someone to tender for the hydraulics, and then they get someone else to tender for maybe the electrics, and get someone else to write a program. And one day all these people get together and they're able to get the machine running, and then they sell it. When they were trying to get it all to going, there were little things they had to do, and they weren't marked on the drawings. And each organization calls things a different name. And we're now finding, as we're doing more and more maintenance, that it's impossible contacting the manufacturer. He just says, oh, yes, we've got so-and-so company do that. They've got into liquidation, and they call themselves another name now. So it's almost a full-time job keeping some of this equipment running, and some of the spares, especially some of the PLCs, programmable logic, is outdated. You can't get them, and so they have to, programs have to be rewritten or modified. So it's an interesting job. Certainly, it keeps me going.
And you really need the experience, isn't it? That's one of the key things, isn't it?
Yes. And on the missiles and the very first rocket I worked on, it was the RTV, that was with Frank Northey. I got involved in the hydraulics on that one and all the problems you can get into with hydraulics, with hammer and instabilities if the gain's too high and all that sort of thing. And so it's all coming, it's all being used, that knowledge these days. My recollection is, for the moon landing, is that we at Tubimbilla, and I think Keeler was the, Keeler's job originally before he joined that, was the TV mechanic. And he was ever so good at that. Anyway, he organized to borrow a color TV from the American embassy. And he modified this and split out the three guns. And we knew that the video that was going to come down from the spacecraft was, in fact, a photograph through three filters. And I made up an interface device and to match it from 50 ohms into what Tony wanted. And on the Man in Space, that we, first of all, in the conference room where we had the TV mounted, saw it in black and white, but then we were able to get it into sync and we saw it in color. My father built his first television set the year I was born, in 1934. BBC was sending signals out at that stage, test signals.
Well, anyway, so that was before 405 lines, wasn't it, I think?
Oh, yes. It was much less than that, I think. 105 rings a bell, but I don't know why I'm saying that.
Could have been.
It was mainly mechanical, spinning discs, Kirchhoff disc or something like that. Yeah. And my father was, in fact, in the Territorial Army when war broke out, and he was in camp. So he immediately became conscripted, and we then followed him around in England. But he was a very keen hi-fi enthusiast, born in 1910, and as radio developed, his father would buy him whatever he wanted, so he had his first radios. But he was always striving for much better hi-fi. And in my youth, I can remember him always making things. And he was a reasonably good pianist, and a friend of his his daughter was a violinist. And the only way they could get good recordings was to cut their own records. So they were cutting their own records. So I sort of grew up with a soldering iron in my hand. And then during the war, he was instructing on gun control. And I think he used to use me as a test bed. So I had a fairly good grounding on how guns were controlled.
Was he involved in any of the radar later in the war?
Not in the war, no. But yep. He was then in Maralinga, and his job there was to find some old radars and get them going. I'm not sure whether they were Mark 7s or 584s. I think they were Mark 7s, the English Mark 7s. We got a couple of those going, and they used them for tracking weather balloons for the Maralinga atomic weapons. Mm-hmm. Another little story on the invention. When I was with EMIs, I can't remember the chief engineer there, on his desk he used to have a huge, great big contraption, and I asked him what it was one day, and he said, it's a photoelectron multiplier. And I said, what's that? He said, well, he said, it's to, if you scan a 35 millimeter in front of this thing, he said, you get a signal out the end of it. And he said, EMI's got a grant, and I forget what the number was, many millions of dollars, to produce this from the British government that was in England. And he said, as a result of this, he said, we produce five. He said, this is one of them. And I said, well, can I borrow it? And he said, yes. So I used that, and we had our own closed circuit TV in the house at home, seeing this $5 million, I think it was $5 million, total electron multiplier. But the government were giving out contracts like that. That was the magnetron, I believe. They got a contract like that. And I did quite a bit of work on an American 584 radar. Trying to keep the damn thing going, but anyway. And when I first went to Long Range Weapons, LRWE, they had a huge, great big hangar place, and it was full of surplus materials from World War II, which included, in one corner, a couple of radar sets, and there was at least one, possibly two, radar sets that could be just dropped on the deck of a ship. But in there were communication receivers and transmitters. And in fact, I used to rummage in there. I pinched one and took one home and had it going at home. And my father, who was working at WRE, needed some night visions to fit on the kinetheodolites in the range. I forget what, he could only find one short, so he took mine back.
Thanks very much to Tony for recording this interview for honeysucklecreek.net, recorded on the 3rd of May 2022.